Yeah, no, okay. All right.
Ready.
All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this rainy Sunday morning. It is nice to be in a bright, warm room with all of you. And we have been so excited about the State of the State series and feeling like we've gotten to hear from an interesting variety of people. And so it is my pleasure today to introduce you to not just our morning speaker, but also my friend, Tim Sullivan, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the New Jersey Economic Development Authority. The NJEDA serves as the state's principal agency for driving economic growth and is committed to making New Jersey a national model for inclusive and sustainable economic development. Now, Tim is from New Jersey originally, so that has been a bit of a homecoming. But prior to that, he served as the deputy commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Economic and Community Development. And prior to that, he served as chief of staff to the New York City deputy mayor for economic development. So he's been doing this in a variety of places for quite some time. But he was born and raised in Bergen County. We have the privilege of knowing Tim because he's also a graduate of Georgetown University. And so he and Heath and Tim's fantastic partner, Ruth Bronstein, who is a brilliant sociologist who I would also love you all to hear from at some point, we were able to reconnect when we moved back to New Jersey in 2019. And in addition to being a brilliant community servant, a fantastic dinner guest. He's also a pretty great dad to Charlie and Emma and has been coaching Little League. So we are very glad that in what I imagine has been a busy weekend that he is also here with us this morning. So before I turn things over to Tim, let's say a quick word of prayer. God, we thank you for the people that you have allowed to serve the people of this state and this country and the world. We pray, God, for wisdom, for the decisions they make, for the ways that they navigate relationships and challenges, some of their making, some not of their making. And God, we pray that you would help us to find the balance between patience and accountability in how we interact with the people who carry out this work on a day-to-day basis. And God, we just ask that you would continually turn our hearts to thinking about the work of policy as the work of how we live together in community. And I pray, God, that you would help us to just be alive to these questions today and moving forward. And thank you for bringing us all here safely this morning. Amen. So with that, help me welcome Tim Sullivan.
Not at all. It was just not turned on. Thank you for that helpful note. It's a real treat to be here. Thais, thanks again for the introduction. Thais is one of those people, as I'm sure as you know, who, if you were told you were forced to plan a mission to Mars or to put together a plan to solve world hunger or, you know, really anything in the world, you'd say, we should probably call Thais to get her involved. I'm not sure exactly what she'll do on the mission to Mars, but she's great people and she's great energy, and I'm sure she'll be a huge contributor to the mission to Mars. So thank you for the kind words, and thanks for the introduction, Thais. Real treat to be here. This is probably the closest in my life I'll ever get to give a sermon, unless there's a big change of professional trajectory for me. So it's a real treat to be in a sacred space and talking. I work in New Jersey politics. I'll try to keep the profanity to a minimum, but no promises, no guarantees. But I thought I'd talk for a few minutes, and then happy to take questions and do some discussion. What a great series you've had with both Charlie Stile and Andrew Zwicker. Andrew in particular, Senator Zwicker, is a hero of mine and an extraordinary public servant, and following in his footsteps from last week is a tall order. I'll try not to disappoint too much, but what an extraordinary person and leader he is. And I know you had a great session with him last week. So what do I do for a living? So I work for Governor Murphy. I came home, as Thais mentioned, I came home to work for the home team in early 2018 when he became governor. And I lead the Economic Development Authority. And economic development can mean lots of things to lots of people. And in a lot of circumstances, it means caring mostly about big businesses and how they're doing and trying to get them to, you know, stay in Jersey, stay in a state, come to a state. And that's part of it. That is invariably part of an economic development ambition. But the way we think about it, and the way Governor Murphy thinks about it, and me and my team think about it, is really trying to think about sort of a comprehensive approach to economic competitiveness and to fairness. So we like to use the words that we're pro-growth progressive Democrats, pro-growth progressive people. And so what does that mean? That means we want to care about growing the pie. We want to continue to grow the economy. We want to make the economy more prosperous. But we care at a fundamental level about inequality. We care at a fundamental level about inclusion. We care at a fundamental level about making sure that everyone's got a seat at the table. We are by no means declaring mission accomplished on any of those fronts, but that is something that is important to us as we think about and wake up every day thinking about what the economy is, for whom the economy works, for whom the economy's benefits should be shared. The answer to that question is everybody. In New Jersey, that means, you know, we're one of the most diverse states in America. That means caring a ton about racial and ethnic and gender and LGBT status and veteran, you know, veteran numbers, is thinking about inclusion and equity at a fundamental level to everything we do. And that's a very different approach, certainly to how things have been done in New Jersey prior to Governor Murphy's time. It's a very different approach to how people think about economic development across the country. So we're doing our best to kind of write a new model or create a new model of inclusive economic development that, again, is focused on growing the economy, sure, but also making sure that there is more equitable access to the resources in that economy. So how's the New Jersey economy doing? It's worth noting. Depending on who you ask, and there's almost always a partisan bent to how you get an answer to that question, I'm going to give you the sort of the administration perspective on this, but it happens to be true and based on the facts. Can't believe that needs saying, that what I'm about to say is true. In a sacred space of all places, I'm not going to lie to you. I'll save that for Monday to Friday. The economy, you know, we have some real challenges in our economy, certainly coming out of COVID and certainly, you know, dealing with generational challenges. That being said, the momentum in our economy is as good as it's been in a long time. We're leading the region in private sector job creation. We're growing the fastest in the region. We were 13th in the country in 2022 for GDP growth. New Jersey usually clangs around the bottom 40s of most state rankings in the economy. We were 13th in 2022. We have more small businesses in New Jersey operating today than before the pandemic or at any other time, because lots of small businesses closed in 2020 and 2021 were awful, awful, awful times to be small businesses. We have a lot of people left jobs at big companies, started new enterprises, have formed new companies. So we have more small businesses in New Jersey today than we did before the pandemic, which a lot of people don't believe. So some closing and some reopening, there's always some churn in the small business part of the economy. Restaurants in particular are, you know, you can do really well and you still open and close a lot. But anyway, we have more small businesses. We're record employment. Our credit has been upgraded 6 times in the last year and a half. Not that we're competitive people, but under the prior administration, the state's credit rating was downgraded 11 consecutive times. Now we're up 6 consecutive times. So things are moving in the right direction in a lot of ways. You know, housing prices are up. Housing prices are up so much it's actually a problem. It's causing an affordability crunch. It's causing a challenge for folks to stay in their home or for a challenge to welcome, you know, new members of the community all throughout the state. But, you know, so our population continues to grow. Most Northeast states are losing population. Our population continues to grow. And so, you know, a lot of things are moving in the right direction. That being said, we have some real challenges. The challenges relate principally or primarily to equity and inclusion and inequality. New Jersey is still one of the most unequal states in America. We're making some progress, but we have a long, long, long way to go on that. You know, your life circumstances are pretty different depending on your zip code, whether that's a school, you know, school system matter, whether that's economic opportunity, to be a young person in Trenton or Camden or Patterson or Newark is different than to be a young person in Princeton or Pennington, where I live, or Summit or Short Hills or Montclair and many of the other wonderful communities that make New Jersey special. Life's really different in those places, despite, you know, a very small geographic span. And so, you know, we think about those things a lot as we think about our economic development strategy, because we're thinking about how do we create prosperity and opportunity for everybody. The governor campaigned the first time on his the agenda that he was, you know, describing as his broader platform was to build a stronger and fairer New Jersey. And those two things, we often get criticized for saying you're doing too much on the fairer side, or sometimes we'll get criticized you're doing too much on the stronger side. First of all, I think we sort of reject that there's not a competitive tension between those two principles. To be stronger is to give yourself more resources, to be fairer, and to be fairer is to give yourself, again, more resilience and strength in your economy. So when we raise the minimum wage, we think that's doing both. When we think about paid family leave, we think that's doing both. When we think about standing up for the environment, standing with workers, standing up for inclusion, standing for justice, we think those are doing both creating a stronger and fairer economy. But we know that we've got real challenges on that journey. And so we're thinking, again, about how we do economic development differently. We care about big companies. We care about our overall competitiveness. We're trying to add more diversification to our economy, both in terms of the people that have opportunity within it, but also industries. So offshore wind, film and television, sports betting, a complicated one to mention in church, but cannabis, financial technology, lots of new industries that are coming to the fore that were virtually non-existent in New Jersey. Film and TV, of course, New Jersey invented film and TV. Thomas Edison invented the motion picture camera in West Orange. The original home of motion picture industry was Fort Lee, New Jersey. It obviously went out west, but it's coming back in a big way. Have you heard of Hollywood? It's a famous place. But anyway, we have folks like Netflix are proposing to build a $1 billion campus on the former Fort Monmouth Army base in Monmouth County. There's four or five other big studio projects that are proposed, mostly in the sort of the northeast corner of the state, up in and around New York City. But that's a brand new industry that's basically coming back and going to create permanent, good, overwhelmingly union jobs. Offshore wind, huge opportunity, not just from an energy perspective and an environment perspective, which it is both of those things, but we're talking about tens of thousands of new jobs in manufacturing, in the assembly and operation of offshore wind. So again, we're thinking about how do we build competitiveness in those sectors. In the wind example, we're building a port in Salem County. Salem County, for those of you who don't know all 21 of our counties and all their glory, it's the second smallest county in New Jersey. It is the second poorest county in New Jersey. It's if you drive to Delaware and leave over the Delaware Memorial Bridge, you are departing from Salem County, New Jersey. Not a lot going on down there economically. We're building a $1 billion port just to service the offshore wind industry, just so that we have an opportunity to manufacture the turbines and the energy generating assets that will drive offshore wind. And when we're done with offshore wind, we're going to power something like half the economy from offshore wind. About half the houses in the state will draw their power from offshore wind. That's a little far off in the future. Don't change your plans for tomorrow about how you're going to generate your power. But it's a huge opportunity economically. It's akin to when they discovered oil and gas under the Gulf of Mexico. There's going to be a bunch of industries. Someone's going to get to be the Houston of offshore wind. We would surely like it to be New Jersey, and particularly South Jersey, which could really use the economic boost. But we also, again, we think about fairness and inequality in our economy as well. So access to capital and entrepreneurship is a huge, huge issue. When the sun is shining and the wind is blowing at your back, Black, Latino, veteran-owned, LGBT-owned, immigrant-owned, women-owned businesses struggle to access capital the way that based on national averages or compared to the rest of the state. So that's an opportunity for us to step in. We're running several $100 million-plus access to capital programs for basically low-interest loans to very small businesses to give them a puncher's chance to grow their business, because banks just do not serve that part of the economy for a variety of reasons, one of which is structural racism, but they don't have the scale to operate with really, really small companies. And when we think about, for example, the term micro-businesses describes them, so 10 employees or fewer. There are a lot of them. There's hundreds of thousands of micro-businesses in New Jersey. Something like 90%+ of all the Black and Latino-owned small businesses in New Jersey are some form of micro-business. When we talk about targeting our very smallest businesses, we're talking about a pretty strong inclusion agenda there. And we've made, tens of millions of loans to those kinds of small businesses to give them a chance to get on, even footing to compete in the modern economy. There's also, we talk a lot about innovation and entrepreneurship. New Jersey, is an innovation state, always has been, and we really want to recapture our leadership position in innovation and entrepreneurship. I'm sure Senator Zwicker talked about this. One of the huge challenges for entrepreneurship is this horrible, disparity in access to capital. Something like 2% of all the venture capital dollars that are raised and invested in startup companies, something like 2% globally, nationally, in New Jersey. The stats are the same everywhere. Less than 2% are invested in companies founded by African Americans or Hispanic Americans. And if you cross-multiply that by women, so women of color, 0.7% of all the venture capital dollars invested in America are going to women of color. That is both a justice and equity problem, of course. It's also a huge economic problem, because those are business plans and visions and dreams and enterprises that are going unfunded that could create lots of jobs. So we're standing up programs to really focus and be laser-focused and purpose-built just to support entrepreneurs of color in New Jersey, because there's a market failure there. And that's where when we think about where we can and should act, despite being a goofball liberal, I'm a free market capitalist at the same time. When the government can't do everything, the government should, let the private sector do its thing where we can. But when there are market failures, or when there are opportunities to enhance our competitiveness with a big investment, like building a port, or when we're working to address a market failure, and I would say access to capital and huge challenges for entrepreneurs are market failures. That's when we can and should act. We also think a lot more, and I promise I'll pipe down in a moment and I'll get to the discussion part, because I'm filibustering a little, but I didn't mean to. We care about economic security. Under Governor Murphy's leadership, the EDA and the state thinks a lot more about economic security than our state ever had before. So, for example, during the pandemic, we ran a program called Sustain and Serve, where there was lots of federal money flying around, and we were just giving out tons of grants to people, which was important work and fun to do, to be part of the solution to a challenge. But someone smart said, well, there's a huge, restaurants are having a huge problem because most of them are shut down, or no one's coming to eat in restaurants, most of us included. There's also obviously tremendous food insecurity in the state, and it was bad before the pandemic. It got really bad during the pandemic. It's down. It's back to sort of the what is considered normal, but unacceptably high level of food insecurity. We provided funds to nonprofits to buy meals in bulk from restaurants that really needed the business. Again, during the peak of the pandemic, when there was nobody coming out to eat, particularly in central business districts where they rely on the lunch, the lunch crowd in Newark and Trenton and Patterson and lots of other places, and took those meal that food and gave them to folks who needed a meal, and in many cases hadn't had a hot meal or a decent, a healthy, fresh meal in a long time. And so it was a win-win-win. Again, we're going to give the money to the restaurants anyway. Why not buy the food and take that, take the food, their product, their produce, and give it to folks in need? And we're continuing to build out those models of how we can attack food insecurity. For example, something like 1.1 million New Jersey residents live in what are called food deserts, including just down the road in Trenton, and, not terribly far away in lots of other places. What can we do to not just build more grocery stores, because it's kind of a vanilla response to a problem is to just build something. And in some places we should do that. Camden, for example, badly needs a grocery store. There's no place in Camden to buy groceries. Atlantic City needs a grocery store. Trenton could probably use another grocery store. So sometimes it's a brick and mortar solution, but how can we bring more healthy, fresh food to people who need it and create some jobs along the way? So we're running a program, this is kind of a pilot program, where the federal government during the pandemic now allows folks who receive food stamps, SNAP, to order online. Before the pandemic, you could not order online. If you had to show up and use your debit card to get your groceries. They changed that during the pandemic, thanks to President Biden and his administration. Well, that's a huge actual shift in how you can think about how to get food to folks, but SNAP does not cover the delivery fee. And you have to be home to get the food, particularly if it's cold, right? If you've got anything that's perishable or whatever. So lots of folks who are working lots of jobs, that's not an option to be home at whenever the Amazon Galler guy can come by. That's just not realistic. And you can't pay for the delivery fee using your SNAP money, which can be expensive. So what we're doing is we're actually going to partner with grocery stores. We're going to buy for them, big refrigerated lockers that can go at a senior center or in a community center or at a church, a church or a nonprofit group, and do bulk orders, where in exchange for us buying you the equipment, you're going to waive the delivery fee, and you're going to, Family X, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, whatever, can go online, order food just like everybody else. The delivery will be waived, use their food stamps to do so, and the food will be dropped off and delivered to some place that is safe and clean and cold and has security and all that. So again, we're thinking about lots of different ways to try and sort of shake up the snow globe a bit on how we can, in the case of food insecurity, bring more food to people, not just build more things. We're also focused on things like childcare. Childcare is economic infrastructure. Thais mentioned my two beautiful and lovely children, who I love very much. We saw too much of them during the year 2020 and 2021. We love being full-time parents. We also have full-time jobs. The childcare is economic infrastructure. Just like if the water stopped running or if the electricity stopped flowing, if the childcare system does not work, good luck getting people to show up for work. It's not going to happen because people will put their kids first, as they should. And if kids, you know, if the childcare system isn't functioning, you do not have a functioning economy. So we're investing. We have an appropriation of a little more than $100 million to invest in childcare infrastructure, the facilities. There's lots of places that serve kids but could serve more kids because they don't have the right HVAC system or the right sprinkler system. They could actually add seats. They could add staff. They could add seats. They could use their full capacity. For example, this is a really silly thing, but it's not silly. This is a really small thing, but it's an important thing. If you don't have, my kids have always gone to daycare that has a little in-the-room, little bathroom for the little guys, which means the teacher doesn't have to line the kids up and go down the hall every time somebody has to go to the bathroom, which, if they're anything like my kids, is every 15 minutes. So it is therefore a staffing nightmare because you've got to have someone to take someone down the hall and someone to stay with the kids. So you've got a horrible inefficiency, and you can just build them a little potty. You would be able to expand the capacity of those places. So we're throwing meaningful money at the idea of expanding capacity in our childcare system. Again, just as an example of, childcare, 1 out of 20 women in New Jersey work in the childcare sector. It's a huge, huge, part of our economy. And again, vital to our economic infrastructure. So we're making those kinds of investments as well. So yeah, we do things like try and get big companies to move here. We do things like try and, grow our key strategic sectors, but we're also trying to intervene smartly, surgically, at a pretty micro level to think about how we can drive economic security, how we can address gaps in the economy, how we can be purposeful, purpose-oriented around inclusion in our economy, and thinking about growing the pie. Sure, if you're not growing, you got all kinds of problems. So you got to grow, but then how do you think about fairer, more equitable, more equal access to what's going on in the economy? So that's what we wake up every day thinking about. And again, we've got real challenges ahead of us. We by no means are we where we want to be on most of those measures, nearly any of those measures, but we're making real progress. Governor Murphy and our team think about this in our sacred space, at that level of commitment to this, because that's why we do economic development. It's why we do the jobs we do. It's not so we can point to the stock market or our GDP stats or other things like that. It's to create jobs and opportunity for people and our residents and create safer, better communities and more vibrant places to call home and attract more people to want to live in New Jersey, this wonderful place. So we got real work to do, but we're making progress and we're moving in the right direction, I think, for the first time in a long time. With that, I'm happy to take some questions or get any feedback. Your hand was up first, ma'am.
I would assume that in New Jersey, as in other states, the economic centers in metropolitan areas are moving out into other areas. And one of the things, I was in real estate stuff, so one of the things of building all the office buildings and all the stuff that we build out here in the 70s, 80s, 90s, adaptive reuse. And I know towns don't want it because it means schools and it means all kinds of other situations, but I also know that some of the owners are looking at that kind of thing of sort of resettling our population and spreading it out into areas. So it's not just people moving out into areas that have good jobs and make a lot of money, but helping to spread out the population. And I know it's ancillary to economic development, but I think it's an important thing to be thinking about.
Couldn't agree with you more. And actually, the only friendly amendment I offered, I don't think it's ancillary to economic development. I think it's central to economic development. So a couple things. I could do like a 3-hour response. I promise I won't. Just you said a lot there that we spent a lot of time thinking about. So there's both a pre-pandemic and now sort of a post-pandemic reality of the suburban-urban workplace shift. In 2019, we were kind of terrified about all the suburban office parks that we were concerned were going to go fallow because of the two dynamics you described. One, there was a bit of a reurbanization, so Jersey City, Newark, Camden, Trenton, places doing better than they had been. And people, particularly young people, wanted to live where they work and walk to work and bike to work and all that jazz, which is still true. But then the pandemic comes along and gives new life to a lot of those suburban office parks because people decided they hate commuting. And I think that's a durable legacy of the pandemic. I think once you stop doing something that's as awful as being in your car for an hour a day in both directions, it's really hard to restart that. So a lot of the difficulty of getting people to go back to the office is people hate commuting. They don't hate being in New York City. They don't hate being in Philly. They don't hate being in Camden or Trenton or Patterson. They hate getting there. So being closer to home is a good thing. Smart towns are thinking correctly about how to do that adaptive reuse, because the reality for New Jersey is we're the densest state in the union, we're the fourth smallest state with the 11th highest population, we're the densest state in America by far. There's not that much land left to develop, you have to redevelop your land. So the idea of a dead office park or a dead suburban office campus in the middle of your, or even in the fringes of your municipality is a horrible thing. It's a horrible tax liability that's dragging around, it's a horrible vibrancy thing. So the idea of adding some restaurants, adding some housing to those facilities is a really good idea. Not every town gets the joke, not every developer and owner gets the joke on that, but that's, I think, the way of the future. And the towns and counties and states that differentiate themselves and thinking about those kinds of great places to build and to those kind of communities to create, I think we'll do well. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Tim. I'm interested in a little bit in how you make the sausage here.
I told you I couldn't use profanity here, so you're risking that already, but okay.
There you go. You have a budget. Where does the money come from, number one? And this is all related. It's really how this thing works, okay? You have a staff. How many people are in that staff? Those people make decisions about the allocation of the resources that you have. How are those decisions made? What are the factors that you look at before you make a decision of, let's say, toilets in nursery schools versus building housing? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, two entirely different things.
We do both, by the way. Yeah, I didn't do the housing part.
All things that the New Jersey Economic Development Authority, I mean, this church is one of the homes of Arm in Arm. Started years ago, but it was, you know, designed to provide food to people who were hungry and mm-hmm. to keep pipes from freezing so that people would have heat in the winter. What is it that the Economic Development Authority is doing, or not what it is, how do you get to where you get? I mean, you talked about the big picture, mm-hmm. but how do you paint in the lines?
Great question. I'm not sure we do it as well as we should, but a couple of things. So the EDA, from a sort of a structural perspective, we're a state authority. We're part of the government. We're not. Some states have sort of a quasi-private entity that does their economic development. We're not. We are a full public sector. Most of the resources we get come from the legislature and governor, who in the budget process will set priorities and make allocations of capital or allow us to issue tax credits in a variety of different directions. So ultimately, the governor, by his proposing of the budget and his signing of the budget and his signing of the laws, sets the strategy at the macro level. I get asked my opinion about what that strategy ought to be, but it ultimately is his call with the legislature. So the childcare example. So there was a piece of legislation passed that said go make $100 million worth of investments in our childcare infrastructure. We then get handed the ball and say, here's a big idea with maybe 3 to 4 pages of accompanying legislation. Go figure it out. And we have to then go do a lot of stakeholder work to listen. I would give us decent grades, and we do a lot of listening, particularly when we're doing something new like childcare, which was a business we'd not been in. We also hired some folks who had some expertise in that. So you asked how many people we have. We have about 325 people, plus some part-time folks and some contractors and whatnot. But core number, 325. Which is not huge. The Department of Labor's got several thousand people. The Environmental Protection Department has several thousand people. So we're, in the grand scheme of things, pretty small and nimble. But we have to make decisions on how to get all that done and how to allocate our own time and that capital. But ultimately, the macro decisions of if you're going to have a program that does housing or childcare or offshore wind or film or whatever, those are made by Senator Wicker and his colleagues in the legislature, and ultimately have to go to the governor's desk for signature.
But how do you make... How do you allocate?
So in that scenario, the legislature is doing the allocating of
they do it all. You don't say This looks like something that we can help develop the New Jersey economy.
So it's iterative. So we'll make, first of all, the governor gets to propose the budget, and the governor gets to propose, how the state's cash, ultimately makes the capital allocation decisions. And I'm in his cabinet. I get to make some recommendations. They don't often get listened to, but that's how that process works. Ultimately that, but then how do you turn something from an idea with a number next to it into a real program that has, a 50-page application that'll get attached to it and all that jazz is the work of, and I mean this lovingly, it's the work of the bureaucracy. We've got folks who are lawyers and, accountants and, financial professionals. We have some child care experts now who come together and craft a program in a pretty unglamorous, making real work out of an idea. So that's the fun work of our team. Yeah. Someone back there. Yeah.
So did...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Keith had it real quick.
Oh, mine is going to be shorter than Keith's. So did the cottage food law have an economic effect?
Then I'm sorry, what did...
The cottage food law where people were allowed to make food in their homes to sell? Did you see any uptick from that?
I think we've certainly... It contributed to... I don't have data to answer that question. I think just sort of in my gut. I think it's part of the entrepreneurial growth we've seen. I think a lot of folks are doing more home-based businesses, which is great. We love that. So I think that's been certainly positive. Yeah. Yes, sir. Okay.
Is this on?
Here, let's click up. There you go.
Okay. First question, and this might have been a Zwicker question, but you brought it up. Okay. So I work for Lockheed Martin, and if you do business with the Department of Defense, you generally have to put about 2% of the business to small businesses.
Yep.
Have you, the governor, and discussed working with the legislature to enshrine some kind of a goal for the banks doing business in New Jersey to cover, the socioeconomic categories that you rattled off in mm-hmm. the beginning as, you can say, well, they're too big or they're not to scale, but you're putting the state of New Jersey in the game. That's a pretty big business too.
Mm-hmm.
So, comment.
Yeah, it's a great question. So when most of those banks actually aren't regulated, they do business here, but they're not really regulated by the state. So their charter is either federal. There are some state chartered banks, but they're generally federally chartered banks. So, and the Federal Reserve and the Community Reinvestment Act. And the Community Reinvestment Act, again, if I had a magic wand, is due for a refresh because that was done probably 25, 30 years ago, and the world's a lot different than when CRA was written. But, yeah, I mean, we work a lot. We often are working in partnership with those banks. So we will, for example, in a financial, in a loan context, we will partner with them. We'll take a piece of a loan. They'll do 80% of loan. We'll do 20% of it. Those kinds of numbers to partner with those banks. So we work very closely, with most, if not all, the banks. Could and should they do more? Yeah. And if we had actual money for every press release they put out saying like they intend to, every advertising campaign that says we love our small business community, but banks should show love with money, not TV ads.
So my second question is about suburbanization.
Yeah.
So how are you thinking about dealing with the fact that it drives our very segregated state to be even more segregated?
Yeah, great question. Part of it's about reinvesting in cities and sort of not just investing sort of in the suburbanization. And also, we don't have much choice at this point. We're kind of as sprawled as you can get at this point between all the places you can't develop and preserve farmland, which I love, and green acres and all that. There's not a ton of land left in New Jersey to develop. So if we're going to continue to grow, we actually got to redevelop our cities. We got to redevelop our brownfields. We got to develop historic properties that have lain fallow. How we think about our transportation dollars matters a lot there too, because the suburban network requires a robust transit and transportation system. And so thinking about how those things come together, thinking about building more building denser housing, and this is a good way for me to get run out of town in a lot of different towns, but thinking about density, thinking about housing that is affordable and or regulated affordable housing is really important. Towns don't want to hear it. You mentioned earlier that they get concerned about schools. Most towns actually have the problem where they're running out of school kids and they're going to have to downsize their school system. So to be worried that schools are coming in, I mean that kids are coming in, is not data-driven, let's go with that. And so, those are, I think, sort of paper tiger type challenges that don't really exist. It's a lot of times a cover for other issues like racism. And so I think that's a huge challenge. But you've hit on the right answer, I mean, the right question. It's a real challenge for a state like New Jersey that is really divided, urban, suburban. I mean, the politics of those places are very different. The demographics of those places are very different. And there's not a clear answer to that question. Your hands up two at once, okay.
Good morning. I recently attended a 2-day workshop on stormwater management related to a new New Jersey law. And every single session started with a statement on environmental justice, which I thought was tremendous. On the other side of the issue, I drive up and down the Route 130 corridor where some of the best farmland in the nation is being paved over by warehouses. So does your agency start your meetings with any statement on environment?
When we start the meetings, I'm not positive, but the governor just signed, the DEP just enacted the most robust environmental justice rules, which are essential. I know.
Okay.
You know, I know. But so that, you know, we are all living under a new and really progressive and really good, strong framework around environmental justice. We don't subsidize warehouses. I don't do warehouse deals. So those are all the private sector operating, because those don't create very good jobs, among other things. They're an environmental real challenge, and they don't create very good jobs. Those are not the kind of jobs we want our kids doing. They're entry-level jobs, and they're important, you know, as an opportunity. I'm not going to ban them, but that's not something we're going to subsidize. And there is a movement. There's been legislation that's been proposed, and I don't think it's made its way to the governor's desk, to regulate warehouse development, particularly on farmland. Individual towns have taken a swing at it. There's not been a statewide answer yet. We're not the land use regulator for the state. There's something called the State Plan, the State Planning Commission. I have a colleague who sits on it, but we don't run it. The warehouse question is a very challenging one because it's an environmental challenge as well. Not just the farmland, but the trucks. It's not there. The technology's not there yet, but we will be there on real electric trucks sometime soon. So the idea that a old-fashioned semi is going to be rolling past your house is going to change, but that's 10 years away probably, because the technology is just not there yet. The battery technology is not there to do electric heavy haul trucks yet. But it's a huge challenge, and you're exactly right. Yes.
Businesses are attracted to New Jersey, is there a process to identify what training for those positions is needed and to see if like local community colleges can provide that training?
Great question. The answer pivots a bit on what sector we're talking about. So let's lovingly pick on pharma. Right, New Jersey has a long, deep, proud history in pharmaceuticals. I'm sure there's people in this room who work in that industry. We're in Mercer County. The odds are you're in the room with someone who works in pharmaland. Which is great, which means we have an existing workforce there that has that you're tapping into. When it's a brand new industry, so it's offshore wind is a good example of that. Film and TV is another good example of that. We're spending a lot of time and a fair bit of your money doing skill development and workforce development with county colleges, with as early as high school. So offshore wind is a huge opportunity, particularly in South Jersey. We're partnering with Salem County Votech, the Gloucester County Institute of Technology to do, as early as upper middle school, like 7th and 8th grade, exposure and early pre-training for opportunities in those industries that, you know, those kids are going to have an opportunity that their parents didn't have because this new industry is coming around. And so we spend a lot of time on that. When it's you know, in an existing industry, the training framework is just a little different. But in new industries, we spend a lot of time thinking about that. Film and TV is another great example. So there's the celebrities that are involved in film and TV. That's fun. But there's a lot of jobs that get created that are, you know, behind the scenes, behind the camera, literally, and we think there's a huge opportunity. So in Newark, in the South Ward, on a former public housing development, pretty much near the airport on Frelinghuysen Avenue, it's been knocked down and cleared. It's been vacant a long time ago. It was not a safe, clean, acceptable place for anyone to live. They're building, it's called Lionsgate, is building a huge movie studio there. It's a huge opportunity for the young people of Newark to get in on a new industry. So we're doing a lot of work with the Newark Public Schools, with county colleges, particularly in Essex County, around how do you create a talent pipeline there and a career opportunity pipeline there. So yes, is the answer to your question. Yes, sir.
What are some of the biggest criticisms that you get in your work? And
never. I've, no one's ever. It's first time for everything, I suppose. But let's see. How honest an answer do I want to give? I think, you know, so I'll list the critiques I would give if I was critiquing ourselves. So the cost of doing business in New Jersey is high. That's a factual reality. Now you get what you pay for. So, you know, a lot of people will tell you that we should just like eliminate the corporate business tax and everything good will, you know, good things will happen. That happens to be wrong. The Tax Foundation puts out rankings every year of like the best states for competitiveness. The number 1, 2, and 3 states in some order are Wyoming, South Dakota, and Alaska. Great. I'm good. So let's not get carried away with, you know, using tax rates as an indicia of competitiveness or success. But, you know, the state's an expensive place to do business. You get the number one public school system in exchange for it. But, you know, cost of energy is very high here. We don't, you know, that's why offshore wind is such a huge opportunity for us. We don't generate much of our own energy in New Jersey. America doesn't generate enough of our own energy to begin with, but we will soon be generating about half of what we need off of our shores. That's now become a national security thing, right? This horrible war in Ukraine. So that's a critique. You know, it's expensive to do business here. It takes, we have a complicated regulatory framework, and that's important, and I support it, right? We care about the environment. We care about labor. We care about those things. It takes a little longer to get things done here than it does in the aforementioned places that don't give a hoot about environmental justice or, sensible planning. So things take a little longer to get done than they probably should. But on balance, I think that trade-off is okay. I'm okay with that trade-off. Can we do a little better? Can we be more efficient? Sure. But taking our time to ask the right questions and make sure that we're getting the right answers is worth doing. Yes, ma'am. Nope. She hasn't gone yet. Hold on. We got frequent flyers. We haven't gone over here yet.
Thank you. I just wanted, if you would follow up a little bit on the offshore wind project.
Sure.
I just remember reading an article some weeks ago about what I guess I would call a NIMBY of the people on the land, that there's something that has to happen on the land that somebody doesn't want down in Salem County or wherever, and who's responsible for trying to persuade those people? Is that your department or somebody else, or can nobody do anything about it?
Great question. What they don't like, you gotta run a big extension cord from the offshore wind farms into the grid. I was an English major, that's basically how I understand it, but they're going to make power out there, and it's got to come ashore somehow. It's not just going to float across the clouds. You got to land that cable somewhere. There's some somewheres that don't love that idea. I think we'll get through it. There's some pushback on, is this going to ruin the view from my shore house and all those things? Those are legitimate questions. I think the facts will bear out that it's not that big a deal. The Department of Environmental Protection ultimately has to issue those permits, and the Board of Public Utilities, those are both sort of sister entities to my team, have the primary responsibility there. They're the regulators and the permitters. But we're involved certainly in making the case for why this is good and all the jobs that it's going to create. A big energy transition is always going to have some pushback. And that's okay. And, you know, democracy is a beautiful thing. We should enjoy it while we have it. And that's okay. Yes. Farming's doing great. So tough, again, had a real tough 2020 and 2021 because relies on a lot of immigrant labor. And when the borders were shut down and people couldn't go anywhere because of the pandemic, you know, it was a tough challenge there. But, you know, we continue to be, you know, the Garden State moniker exists for a reason and persists for a reason. We have a really important agriculture sector. Particularly in South Jersey. You've seen a lot of that migrate to things like, you know, wine. We're growing more grapes here. We're making more wine here. I'm personally in favor of that. It's been doing well. But, you know, but there's a real challenge. I think you mentioned earlier, you know, the development challenges around pristine land are very real. So preserving farmland is really important just from a ecological and a balance perspective as well. But the sector's doing generally pretty well. You know, we're big in, obviously, cultivation. We're not big in ranching and, you know, cattle and hogs and all that, but because it's pretty land intensive, among other things. But the agriculture sector is doing well and rebounded pretty nicely from a very, very, very tough 20 and 21.
John, you got the last question.
Wow. Two what extent do you get involved in PPP, in public-private projects? It would seem to me it would be a good way to leverage the money that you have with the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost everything we do is in some form or fashion, you know, a partnership with the private sector. There's very little that we do this, you know, purely, fully government-y. You know, the private sector has a different risk appetite, though. So, for example, you know, a P3 opportunity that sort of stares us in the face is this port we're building in South Jersey. Now, we're using a private contractor. We don't employ the people that are swinging the hammers. It's the South Jersey Building Trades, and they're doing a great job. So, in theory, that's in sort of a public-private partnership already. But in theory, you could have said, hey, why don't we get some developer to build that and take all the risk? They wouldn't, because it's much too much development risk, the permitting risk. It wasn't going to happen. But when there are opportunities for that, we absolutely look for that. So we're building a project in New Brunswick called the Helix, which is it stands for Health and Life Sciences Exchange. Helix. But we're building that with a private developer who's going to, you know, we're subsidizing it, we're funding it, but they're taking the construction risk, they're taking the development risk, they're taking the lease risk and all that. So we look to partner with the private sector, you know, wherever we can.
We, unfortunately, coffee hour is going to come. Tim is going to be here. You can ask a couple more questions. But very quickly, can we give Tim a quick round of applause? And I want to thank you all for your attention and your fabulous questions throughout the series. I personally think that it is so vitally important that as individual citizens, we understand what's happening at the state level. There is so much that we can do locally that when we are feeling frustrated federally, there is an opportunity to really kind of put our vote and our time to work here. And so just thank you all for showing up for this. And I want you all to know that next week, we will have Dan Migliori here talking about Jesus and the wild beasts, incarnation and the natural world. So I hope you'll join us. Thanks, everybody.